call the House State Affairs Committee meeting to order. Today is Friday, March 15th, 1991. The time is 8:36. We have present today Representatives Moyer, Bruckman, Baker, Miller, Cabina, and Shilkett. Today we'll be taking up Senate Bill 18 relating to investment of pension funds, House Bill 40 relating to false information on election pamphlets, Senate Bill 32 relating to tourist benefits for youth center employees. We have a number of people signed up today to testify. First bill I'd like to take up is Senate Bill 18. Senator, would you join us? First bill before the committee, Senate Bill 18 by Senator Pichot relating to the investment of pension funds. Senate Bill 18 is the companion bill to Representative Ulmer's House Bill 37, which was previously heard in this committee. You'll also find a copy of the State Affairs CS for House Bill 37 in your packets. This time I'd like to have Senator Pichot join the committee and brief on Senate Bill 18. Good morning, Senator.
Mr. Chairman, thank you very much, and thank you for the opportunity to speak on the bill this morning. This bill is very similar to a bill I believe you've already heard by Representative Ulmer, and is the product of work during the interim of Representative Ulmer and myself following consideration of somewhat similar legislation in the legislature last year, that two different versions of a bill were brought before the House and the Senate, and reconciliation of some major differences was not possible. Actually, probably was a good thing in that during the interim we held hearings and worked with a lot of the groups on how best to handle the management of our PERS and TERS pension funds. And I think the product of that you see before you is a better product and a more thoughtful, laid out structure than either the bills that were considered last year. Mr. Chairman, you have some schematics and some summaries, I think. One is kind of this chart with the boxes outlining the basic structure of the Alaska State Pension Corporation, which would be charged with managing the PERS account, the Public Employee Retirement Fund, the TERS, the Teacher Retirement Account, as well as the Judicial Retirement System, the Military Retirement Fund, and the Supplemental Benefit System. And of course, it's that last account, SBS, that we've all heard and read so much about, in that we made some investments through the Department Administration that have proven to be somewhat shaky. We've had problems with the portfolio, which has largely been invested in what's called GICs, or guaranteed interest document or instruments, and because the insurance companies that were purchased from them had a lot of so-called junk bonds. Their future is uncertain at this time. We managed to get out of some of those, but we still have a considerable amount of the $700 million or so in SBS still with Executive Life, the first executive, I think the parent company is. Nothing is going to change that situation. Those are contracts. We're going to have to deal with them one way or another. But the kind of new corporation we envision here, which removes the fiduciary relationship from on our pension fund investments from either the Department of Revenue Commissioner or the Department of Administration Commissioner, is designed to avoid that kind of situation in the future by providing normal or routine, comprehensive, prudent investor rule-oriented investment schemes or plans to these very large $5 billion plus monies. And it's a system that is very similar to most other states. Most other states do not have sole fiduciaries or trustees like a Department of Revenue Commissioner in charge of these funds. Rather, they have a board. The structure of those boards nationally looks different. Every state is a little bit different. Some have a lot of ex officio members, cabinet officers, et cetera. Some have a lot of public members. Some have combinations. Some have beneficiary groups. Some don't. We looked at a lot of these models, and we heard from some expert investor types who work with boards, particularly pension boards. They came up, testified. There were some pros and cons to every system. There was a couple of things that rang true for me, though. One was they said sometimes structure becomes less important than the people on those boards, so you want to have a system that encourages the very best, most dedicated, knowledgeable people, and not necessarily knowledgeable from a technical portfolio investment standpoint. That the experts told us that you need not have Wall Street investors on your board. You have to have a board, though, that has ready access to those investors, and this board reflects that through the development of the Investment Advisory Council, which is a small group, 3 to 5 members that the board hires on contract for, you know, several year period, and they provide the direct technical advice to a board. The second thing that rang kind of through these discussions for me is that the newest of the boards being created in other states tended to directly involve beneficiaries. It isn't always the case that beneficiaries, you know, TERS, PERS, employees, serve on these, but the model now, if there is a model or the trend, is to include beneficiaries and to approximate a balance on the board so that you have employers represented and employees represented. And of course, in Alaska, it's not, remember, just the state that's an employer. Only, I think, about 48% or so of PERS people are actually state employees. The rest work for largely municipalities, but also school districts have PERS people. And of course, we have school districts employing the bulk of the TERS people, although there are some TERS people also in the state. So it's a mixed system, but I think we need to provide for school districts, municipalities, in addition to the state, on these boards, because if there's a liability out there, it's really to the employers, that the contributions in retirement are fixed for employees. Currently, for example, most public employee groups pay 6.1 or 6.something%, some fire and police pay somewhat more. The balance is paid by the employers. That balance goes up and down due to lots of things, the cost of health care for retired employees, but also investment returns on the fund. And you can bring those that balance of the contributions necessary for an actuarially sound fund through good investments. And I think this kind of a system doesn't guarantee high rates of return, but it sure maximizes the chances of receiving those when you're bringing in a lot of people looking at a lot of different kinds of allocation of investments through, you know, fixed income, equity, et cetera. And I think that this kind of system is key to minimizing, you know, those upward fluctuations in employer contributions in the future, as well as the whole actuarial soundness of the fund, which clearly, if the fund isn't sound, at some time we got more people retiring and taking benefits, and you got people paying in. It's really the employers and the state that bear that added financial responsibility. So what this board composition contains, which is somewhat different from the bill, I believe that passed out of your committee, is it calls for a balance of board composition of and again, it gets a little complicated with, you know, SBS and PERS and TERS, and so. But I think we've tried to satisfy all the beneficiary interests or all the participants by having one active PERS / active SBS, one retired PERS, one active TERS, one retired from any system other than PERS, which could be, you know, retired TERS. Or remember, we also have some judges and we have some military people in this, although those amounts are fairly small. Then on the other side, we have two employers nominated by member employers like school districts and munis, the Commissioner of Revenue representing the state, and then the eighth member is an agreed on member by the other board members. That could, and I think as that would be envisioned, is to fill the holes on, depending on the kind of representation, the board might want somebody with some real financial, specific financial knowledge. It may turn out that there's another system employee that, you know, there maybe the school district for some reason weren't being represented, or it's a chance of even further balancing it out by unanimous consent, which clearly would favor strong candidate board members of hopefully objective persuasion. But I have cautioned people in the committees that this bill has gone through that I don't think the realities of their decision making are going to reflect 4-4 votes or 5-4 votes, or that has not been the history of investment boards. In the history outside, as well as in our state and through our PERS and TERS boards, has been consensus. These kind of boards typically work by hearing professional advice, thinking it over, talking it out, and moving forward with large investment decisions. It does not become we and they in most cases. That is the experience. So I think that we need not get quite so hung up on who's outvoting who. And I frankly believe that this does provide that kind of balance that we're seeking. Mr. Chairman, I talked a little long. One thing I would want to mention, a couple of changes in the bill. We have made adjustments or changes already on some of the things that your committee made. For example, I know there was a lot of discussion on just cause removal. We had that similar debate in the Senate Finance Committee, and we went back and I think satisfactorily addressed just cause, and you can see where we're limiting it to physical and mental capabilities to do a job, not political party or, you know, because you don't like somebody. And I think we tightened that section up. The other one is there was a lot of discussion about whether or not we were ready for or should encourage the integration of benefits management, which is something going on in the Department of Administration now. It's a fairly complicated issue. I think it's going to take several years to really come to grips with whether or not we want the same board to manage the benefits as well as invest the funds. For the time being, we have deleted all language related to management, to benefits management being integrated. That's a decision down the road. It doesn't preclude it. It's a new topic. I think we just need to address it fresh. So there is no mention of that. Finally, Mr. Chairman, the question of foreclosure of pension-owned properties, or the payment of taxes on foreclosed properties owned by the pension fund, I know has come up. Nationally, as you probably know, pension funds, not just in Alaska, but all over, receive tax-exempt status. I mean, their properties are not taxed as kind of a matter of historical tradition like religious properties. That's not good or bad, I think, anymore in today's day and age. I had kind of resisted getting into that area, did not treat it. Although on reflection and listening to some of the municipal people, I think there's a good case to be made, particularly for foreclosed property. It is a cost to the fund. It will cost a couple hundred thousand bucks in taxes. They do own foreclosed property. I think this is a small business price to pay, and there's some economic equity in that. I've prepared an amendment, I think, that you and your staff have seen, and I think addresses would include the provision that there would be tax liability, property tax liability, on foreclosed properties owned by the pension corporations. In a way, it puts a little bit more thought, perhaps, in the board's real estate policies on purchasing. I might add, I was pretty wide-eyed when we looked at property owned by, or the percentage of property owned by the PERS portfolio. It is quite high, higher than most states' pension fund, and also higher by most people's rule of thumb on allocation of assets. There's usually 5% or 10% real estate, and 50% in equities, and 30 or 40% in fixed income. Ours, I kind of forget what the percentage is, in itself, and it seems like it was quite high. And I think a new board may want to look at their real estate holdings. They were also losers, by the way. That was true in lots of areas of Alaska in the last few years, but the real estate investment dragged down their rate of returns in recent years, although they've done average returns for their other parts of the portfolio. Mr. Chairman, I'd be happy to shut up and entertain questions.
You had this integration of benefits administration in your original bill, didn't you?
Yes.
And then you determined that it was just better to leave it out.
Yeah. It raised more questions than it answered, and it doesn't preclude the discussion of that whole topic a couple of years down the road. I think with the change of administration, it lacked the background and the in-depth review to really move forward on that.
I think we had it in 37 within a time specific that they would do that, and then we changed the time specific to whenever prudent or something. And
yeah.
Okay. And I like the removal of the board for cause. I think that's a good addition. You did not originally have deferred compensation in your bill either, but you determined to go ahead and add that.
What we've done, Mr. Chairman, is not to add it directly. We've left it open to negotiate with the Department of Administration with that this board could take over the investment. We haven't mandated it, but we've also said if it's left there, the department administration shall consult with the advisory council here. Of course, the cost would all be accounted for that from deferred comp. But deferred comp is not a pension fund. It's a little different animal. It's voluntary. People can, in many areas, they can choose what investments they want. I don't want to speak for the new administration, but I think they have ideas on what that might look like that might be different in the future. I think they're looking at menu-driven investments by the individual. There's pros and cons on that. So we've left the door open. It can be done administratively, but we haven't mandated it because it's a little bit different animal.
Is there any pension funds left under administration now? This will take them all.
This would take all the pension funds, right. And I say pension funds, saying SBS, there is a legal argument that SBS is not quite a pension fund either, because in that, if you quit, you can take it out. You don't wait till age 65 or 62, or there's no retirement per se date or action attached to you, other than leaving state service or teacher service to remove those funds. Pardon, not teacher service. It only applies to people, public employees, and mostly state, although there are a few localities, municipalities that do participate in SBS.
Questions from the committee? Well, obviously, you've done a lot of work on this, and we've heard this bill quite a bit also before, and I think we came to the conclusion when we passed it out that the real, a number of the controversial or issues that maybe were in disagreement over in the Senate was going to be decided in the Senate Finance Committee, and obviously you guys have come to some decisions. We have a number of people that would like to testify on this bill, so did you have a question, Representative?
Quick question, Mr. Chairman. Senator Frischel, on the amendment that you've offered, I'm assuming this is it?
Cramer 311.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Cramer 311. Okay. You speak about foreclosure, and my question, sir, is does investment properties, does your amendment address the property taxes as a whole through the properties?
If I understand your question, Representative Choquette, the amendment only addresses foreclosed properties. It would retain in place the historic traditional tax exemption for non-foreclosed properties owned by the pension corporation. This was something that the municipality, there may be representatives from the municipal league, but I think
we have a letter here also from the AML in there. Do you have that exemption?
No, but Mr. Chairman, I have a letter from the municipality of Anchorage, which voices my concern that any agency that wishes to invest in property should be willing to take the same risk and have the same type of business expenses as the private sector. My concern, Senator Grigio, is that these people need to be playing on the same field. I have a bit of a problem with exempting this type of an operation from property taxes. Your amendment covers foreclosure, but it doesn't go as far as to cover all property taxes. And I'm wondering if you just comment. I know I heard you say that traditionally across the United States this is the way it's done. I like tradition as much as the next person, but I do like to see an even playing field here. These people are out to make money from a pension fund by investing, and I have a little difficulty in accepting that they should be exempt from property taxes.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Choquette, I appreciate the philosophical argument myself, but it's a philosophical argument in that the argument doesn't stop there. What about the SOB building across the street? Shouldn't they be paying taxes to Juno? What about the Masonic Temple down here across the street? Shouldn't it be paying property taxes? The church up the road here. There are, in our Title 29, laid out very specific property exemptions. State municipal facilities and federal facilities are exempt from taxation, and the history has been that these aren't just private, they're not private dollars, they are our dollars, they're state dollars. They're, you know, this is an instrumentality of the state, and these are public monies for public purposes in a sense that our public employees are, you know, public servants. That's not too redundant. And that the property is akin to the SOB building across the street. It's not akin to Burger King facilities, for example. I mean, it you know, for 200 years been treated differently, just like churches and nonprofits. But I mean, I think most of us would probably philosophically, you know, agree with that. It's just that you don't solve that issue through one part of a large body of law governing tax exemptions.
Mr. Chairman, just one quick follow-up.
Yes, okay.
Senator, the building across the street is owned by the state. That's correct. The cost of doing business. Pension fund is more or less an investment, a block of investment funds. I can't draw the similarities in an operation where you're putting money in to make money, or you have a direct expense for state operations. That's all I have.
Rep. Tim Moyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So I'm looking at the position paper, funds to be managed, and wondering why E-4s is not on there.
Let's see. E-4s is only in we would have included, but it is a direct appropriation. They don't manage. We're not managing funds. We just pay the retirees what they get and what they're eligible for. There's no fund itself, which has a whole other history to it. But that program, of course, will fade out when the last legislator dies. Who was in service prior to 76 or 77 or somewhere in the mid-late 70s, that whole system was converted and it will fade away. But now that it's
a dead class.
Yeah, it's a direct appropriation. There's no managed funds. Also, one final comment. I may have misled people a little bit in thinking that the pension fund outright owns and doesn't pay taxes on a lot of property. I mean, in many cases, I think that it's through a mortgagee who does pay taxes. I mean, it doesn't mean that every interest they have in a piece of property is tax exempt. That I don't know the percentage. That someone from revenue may be able to answer that question, but it's not. Like for example, the permanent fund also, their properties are technically exempt. They don't own by policy more than 50%. They're just partners, like the Tyson's Corner development in Washington, outside Washington, D.C. They pay taxes on it for sure to Fairfax County, despite the 30% ownership by the permanent fund. So I think there's probably a lot of situations where my guess would be a majority of the properties that they have ownership interest in or because they go through mortgagees would be paying taxes.
Chairman?
Representative,
what, for example, Senator, what would happen if this fund bought a 20-unit apartment complex in Anchorage? Would they be exempt from taxes under your proposal? They would be.
Well, I would defer to somebody. Maybe there's somebody here from Revenue who's gone through that. I just don't. There are so many different ways of ownership. I don't know how that would work. I don't know if they own a building outright or not. My guess is they normally would go through bank loans or go through third-party financial institutions and probably then end up paying taxes. Or that entity would be paying taxes, not the... Probably doesn't make sense to 100% own anymore. I would think that would not be prudent.
Rather than to maybe belabor this point just on this one, maybe we'll discuss this more when we take up the amendment itself.
Mr. Chairman, thank you very much.
Thank you, Senator. If you're going to stay with us, please join us. If you're not, why? Do you want to?
I have to start my own meeting
right
here 2 minutes ago.
Well,
Mr. Chairman, thank you.
We'll try to handle your bill with kid gloves here, Senator. Do I have a Shaw is the last name.
First name's Viola.
Viola?
Yes.
I just wanted to comment briefly on the makeup of the board.
Ms. Shaw, would you state your name and address? Well, we've got your address written.
I'm Viola Shaw. I represent the, I'm legislative chairman of the Alaska State Retired Teachers Association. And it's the only association that actually represents retired people only. I live at 631 West 11th Street in Juneau.
Thanks, ma'am.
One of the thing, first things on here about the board that concerns me is the even board. And the legislature many times has found out itself what happens when you have an even number of people, because there have been sessions of the legislature that have been hung up because we've had the same number of Democrats as we've had Republicans. And you certainly wouldn't want a meeting of a board to be hung up on an issue because you've got an 8-member board. As the bill came out originally, I believe it was a 9-member board. And House Bill 37 does have a 9-member board. And if you put that extra person back in, I'd like to see it be a retired teacher. We've sometimes had difficulty getting our opinions heard on things. Or listened to. We've come to and testified to things, but it took us 10 years to get last year's bill for the PRPA through. And so if you add that extra person, because we do not, as retired teachers, have a representative on the board, as Senator Pichot has put it, there is an active teacher but not a retired person. And we would like to see a retired teacher on the board, so that would be your extra person.
Well, Shaw, it does have a position here for an active TERS person, and then another retired person other than PERS. Obviously, there'll be far more TERS people out there than there are these others other than PERS, and the voting strength of those people could certainly, it would seem easily elect a second or a retired TERS person.
Well, I would like to see that one position left for those people that are out there, such as the judges. I believe the military is in this, is it not?
Yes,
the National Guard. And I'd like to see those people at least have some representation too, without PERS and TERS taking them all. And that's why I would recommend, I think, a 9-member board. And most of the hearings that were held last summer, although did not attend them in Anchorage, we sat here in a conference room and listened to them. And most of them recommended an uneven board, rather than a 7-member board, a 9-member board, 11-member board, that type of thing, rather than having an even number.
Any questions from the committee?
Mr. Chair. Okay. Ma'am, you heard Senator Pichot state that historically, traditionally, the board reached decisions through consensus. Are you saying that that's not the case?
I'm saying that sometimes a board, if you've got 8 people and you don't always, you can divide evenly on an issue.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
So that you could get tied up with one.
Thank you, Ms. Shaw. Welcome to Marie Darlin.
Darlin, and I live in Juneau, and I am a state retiree and was involved with many of the discussions that went on last year regarding this proposal.
Your address, ma'am, is box 2-1283 in Juneau?
Right. I live at 2150 Glacier Avenue. I presented written testimony as well on this bill in October and raised a few points, which I'd like to repeat again. One is why officers and employees of the corporation are members of the exempt service. And I raised that point at that time, and Rita received no question, no answer as to why the employees had to be members of the exempt service. To me, they are state employees, the same as any other state employee, and so I really don't see the reason for them having to be exempt. This is officers also, and if there's a feeling that there is a need that some of the officers possibly be in exempt service, that might be a little more understandable, but not for employees. Certainly, I don't think we want this to be an office that if somebody with a new administration wants to come in, they can clean house. It's a case of where you do need some people who have been there a little while, have some historical knowledge of it at least. One other question that I have is, again, which I had raised before, the inclusion of SBS, because it is not technically a pension fund. And when we started all these discussions, it was the idea that these were pension funds we were attempting to work with and provide the best way of investments and so forth. So I think that, again, is a question, as Senator Porcio said, it's debatable. Those are really my only comments, other than I also do feel that a nine-member board would certainly be more workable and allow for a little better representation.
Questions from the committee? Okay, thank you, ma'am. Willie Anderson?
I'm Willie Anderson. I represent NE Alaska, and we have submitted a position paper on this bill. Our only concern with the bill as it's currently constituted is the composition of the board. We've worked with Senator Pichot and have made a lot of progress on the other issues that we had on the bill, and we've expressed our concerns on House Bill 37. The composition of the board continues to be a problem, as stated by other people who testified here this morning. The issue about a nine-member board, as it is constituted in HB 37, in our opinion, is a better solution to the problem. It isn't that we don't support the consensus model of decision making, but as in any tight decision, there's always a potential that you're going to get into a 4-4 split. There's always the potential that some group who have a vested interest in the retirement system would not be represented. And we would encourage you, as you did with the assistance of the bill sponsor in 37, to constitute this board with 9 members. And we strongly support the other parts of the bill, and we have no objections to the senator's proposed amendment to the bill in terms of the taxation of foreclosed properties. That's an issue that's been out there, and it probably should be resolved at some point. So we are supportive of the bill, with the one exception of the composition of the board, and we would encourage you to give that serious consideration.
Willie, my understanding then is you would like this ninth person to specifically say TERS retirement.
We would want a retired teacher, yes, because that person isn't, there's no obligation for that person to be there. I submit to you the argument is well-founded that the majority of the people voting in the election would most likely elect a TERS person. But the other side of that coin is that you then leave out judicial and military people for participation. So that creates a problem in this representation. So yes, that's our position. If you have a competition for a position between military and judicial, then over time we could get some representation from both sides of the issue. But a retired teacher should be the other designated seat.
Of course, if we took that to an extreme, we would want to make sure that we had a active and retired person from each of these systems, which would probably put us up to 11-member board.
Oh, it potentially could get us up to 15 members if you get all the systems and get a retired and active person from each of the systems, grant you. And that's why we're not, I mean, the situation is the numbers. We have a large number of retired teachers. We have a fairly high number of retired judiciary people, not as large as teachers. We have a fairly high number of military retired people who are participating. And so that whole issue, the way that the senator dealt with the SBS and PERS, having a person who participates in both systems, I think is a very well-structured way of dealing with that situation. But
I might argue that in essence, what it has done is remove the possibility of people who are in PERS that do not receive SBS, for example, school district personnel. they do not have a seat on here now either. So in that respect, maybe we need to add another one to them.
You make a very good point.
I think another thing, of these four elected people, really they're going to have the control, assuming that you're thinking of us and them, the four elected and the four appointed, or excuse me, the three appointed, you're going to be able to appoint one other person also. So if the sympathies of these elected people would be to an active or retired person rather than an employer type person, you're really going to have another position there that you guys have control of also.
Potentially, but I would, as I would envision it, and as the senator stated, the potential there is to have a person with some financial experience to be that appointee, so that you have a voting member with the financial experience on the board, so that there will be ready advice when the board meets, not necessarily having to wait on the advisory board or requesting information from the advisory board every time. You have that sitting experience. I mean, I grant you, none of us can foresee how the board will make that decision, but that would be the ideal way of making that decision, at least from our perspective.
I would probably take the opposite argument, and that would probably be a dangerous position to take, because then the board would be relying too much on one person's opinion in financial matters rather than an advisory group that they would be looking at for those kind of decisions. So I think that might be dangerous in itself.
I see what your point is, but I don't agree with that point in terms of saying that if you have an equal voting member, that person has no more power per se than another voting member, and he or she can make their opinion known. The committee will make the decision whether they accept it. They also have, for their benefit, that advisory group out there who may make a different opinion, so they have that access there. So there's a balance in that whole situation that we foresee.
Questions from the committee? Okay.
Mr. Chairman, once again, I see a general feeling here that the board is going to be structured and it's going to work in such a way that it's going to be fighting against each other on an issue. I don't believe that's going to be the case. I have to once again reiterate what Senator Pershaw said. The objectives of this board of directors is going to be to work together to make money for the pension fund. And I disagree with the fact that we need another member, especially from a situation to where it might be stacked and one area might be represented more than another. Thank you.
Representative Baker.
Mr. Chairman, the further we get into this, the more concerns I have about the composition, period.
Yeah, exactly.
That you're managing $35 million worth of people's hard-earned monies.
$35 million? Closer to $5
billion. $5 billion. Millions, trillions.
It's how he's already been in government too long.
So I just want to make sure everybody's awake this morning. But, you know, this is an enormous amount of money, and I think we ought to have the very best financial managers that we can find. I mean, you know, because that really benefits the people, and, you know, I respect all the people that have retired and worked hard, but boy, I think you should go out and really get, maybe that board should be composed of financial managers. I mean, maybe it's three, maybe it's five, but that's where the people really benefit, other than, you know, a retired person, you know, they're well-deserving, well-intentioned folks, but when you're talking about billions, the guy that can get the best return, the best bang for the buck, and whether we're arguing about whether they pay property taxes, is probably, you know, when you look at the composition of the permanent fund board, for example, those people have specific expertise and long-term expertise in managing huge amounts of dollars. And I don't know, I'm sure the senator has thought that this through very carefully, but maybe somebody ought to revisit and just think about how we're going to manage $5 billion.
Well, even the, let's say, the permanent fund board does not have people that are specifically for that, but they have the ability to hire. And this board, it's set up the same way. That's what
I differ with that, Mr. Chairman. You look at the composition of the permanent fund board, and you see likes of Mark Langland and folks like that that really are, have a background in financial management. You know, we get, I mean, and they all get permanent fund checks too. You know?
Just as all these people, just as all these people receive. Well, your point's taken,
I think it's well taken.
Absolutely.
Regarding permanent fund board, I believe that's a smaller board and has an even number of people, six.
That's right. But they all come with a financial management background. That's what they look for, and they look for people on the board.
I'm not trying to be argumentative on, in terms of, because these are really good people, and it's been structured in a certain way, but still it's an awful lot of money.
Representative
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. With your permission, I would differ with the previous speaker in that we have an investment advisory council, executive director, chief investment officer, investment staff. There's your expertise, the knowledge of the financial world. I think it's important to have a makeup of the board for the people who are directly affected. And they can direct the experts. For instance, in certain investments, perhaps they don't want to invest in South Africa, these kinds of things. You know, these directly affect the people, the beneficiaries, and I applaud the effort to incorporate them into the system. I would, I do have some concerns over the even numbers on the board. If the permanent board is even and it seems to work well, I'm somewhat relieved. But and I could see a retired teacher because I think the numbers are high. Anyway, to make it short, I concur with the attempt and makeup of the board.
If I might, if we could go on and hear the rest of the witnesses, and then we'll come back to committee debate on this. Thank you, Willie.
Thank you.
Daryl Rexwinkle, Department of Revenue.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Daryl Rexwinkle, I'm Deputy Commissioner, Department of Revenue. I haven't been with the state very long. I might give you a little background. Before that, I was with the Municipality of Anchorage as Chief Fiscal Officer, and I dealt with the Anchorage Police and Fire Retirement System for 3 years, two of those years as its chairman. So I do bring a little experience on pension benefits and investment of pension benefits and what have you. Maybe I might bore you because it sounds like you've been through this before and like last year, but it kind of helps me to go through it myself because I thought about this a little bit when I was with the Municipality of Anchorage when this subject first came up for the state of Alaska. But I've been doing a lot more research into it since I started with the state. And it seemed like the purpose of this thing was to expand the fiduciary from one person, basically, the Commissioner of Revenue, to a board. And maybe we should even look behind that, and I'll get into that a little bit later, but the real fiduciary is the state of Alaska. But the fiduciary then was to be expanded from the Department of Revenue to a board. I basically agree, and I think that the Commissioner of Revenue agrees, that a board concept is a good idea to manage the investment so not just one person is calling the shots, you might say, and where the money's invested, but to put it to a little bit broader horizon. Practices, especially with regards to international equities, there was some big flap about that, and it had to do with the auditors and how we were accounting for international equities. That was one thing. And then there was a lot of, I think, misconception regarding the management of PERS and TERS pension funds and investment performance and cost of doing business. And I think there were also some ill-conceived comparisons to the permanent fund corporation. And as a result of these problems and some of these perceptions, Legislative Audit performed an audit, which was dated, and there may have been more than one, but the one I saw was dated June 19, 1989. Legislative Audit made a few recommendations, including some more doing a better job of performance measurement, which measures the performance of the portfolio. And generally, you try to measure the entire portfolio performance, the equity performance, the fixed income performance, the real estate, anything else that you may be into. And then there was the accounting issue regarding the international securities. And the other one was the fiduciary board. Well, the first and second items, the accounting practices and performance measurement, were implemented, you might say. I've got some concerns over performance measurement myself. I don't know if we're still doing a real good job of management. Believe me, we're getting on top of it. The last performance measurement report we have from SEI is dated June 30, 1990. I mean, to me, that's just unacceptable, and that's going to change. But I think what we're looking at here is some big change to fix a management problem. And management is what really needs to change here. Legislative audit also made some observations. One is that when we look at pension funds, we need to look at the long-term horizons. We're not looking at what's going to happen tomorrow, the next day, next week. But the state of Alaska, hopefully, I mean, we think about the Prudhoe curve, and some people think somehow we may dry out, but that's not the case. The state's going to be here for years. Retired employees are going to be receiving their retirement monies for years, and we've got a current employee, and that process is going to go on. So we look at long horizons. We don't want to look at, gee, we lost money last year. We didn't do as good as somebody last year or last week or today. But we need to start broadening our horizons. And on the other hand, the Permanent Fund Corporation, and their stated objectives, looks at a much shorter horizon. They're really into low risk and more revenue, more return, so they can give permanent fund dividend checks. And then it was alleged, and this is all in that legislative audit report, it was alleged that Treasury managed funds were among the worst performers. But they go on to say, you just can't look at the short term again, you have to look at the long term, and that's what counts. And then they went on to say that returns, for the most part, PERS and TERS and PFC, which is Permanent Fund Corporation, achieved competitive returns on domestic equities as compared to the Standard & Poor's 500. Now, that's a pretty good statement. They achieved competitive returns. And it also said that PERS and TERS fixed income portfolio, which is bonds, basically bonds and treasuries and things like that, outperformed the Shearson-Lehman Bond Index, in each of the 4 years compared. Now, PFC also achieved a competitive return. So I think they're saying that the rates of return are not all that bad. And I might just give you a little information, if you will. For the 5 years ended, June 30, 1990, the 5 years ended, the permanent fund earned 11.3%, average 11.3% return on the money, 11.3. The retirement funds earned 12.4%. Now, that's 1.1% difference. Some people say it costs a little bit more, and I'll get into that briefly, but it costs more to run the PERS and TERS. Well, 1.1% greater rate of return on $5 billion, what is that? I mean, that's in excess of $50 million a year. That 1% rate of return differential, and that's 1 year, $50 million more money that PERS and TERS earned on its money than it would have if it had earned the same rate of return on the permanent, as the Permanent Fund Corporation did. That's not to say that the Permanent Fund Corporation didn't do a good job. They did an excellent job, as a matter of fact. But they have a different investment strategy. They're looking more at the short-term horizon versus a pension fund looking at the long-term. And I might add, though, if you're interested, the Police and Fire Retirement System for Anchorage, that's really the only other state pension fund that's in existence. I mean, municipal-type fund of any size at all. Almost everybody else is in PERS and TERS. That fund earned 13.7% for that period of time. And that's another 1.3% higher. I mean, now we're talking about another $70 million on top of that. So we're talking about big money here for just a slightly different rate of return. And there's been some comments about these different returns. I'll tell you, they're audited. I've got the audit report right here from KPMG Pete Marwick that testified to these rates of returns for PERS and TERS. Okay. And then it was alleged that the cost of administrating PERS and TERS was out of control compared to the permanent fund. But as the legislative audit said, you have to keep in mind, PERS and the Treasury is not just managing one fund, it's managing several funds, and it has several other duties and obligations. And so they said if you just took a look at the people to manage the pension fund money, it was 11.3 full-time positions. And that was to manage, invest, and account for PERS and TERS and these other funds at a cost of $655,000, which includes real estate. And the Permanent Fund Corporation had 16 positions at a cost of $863,000, right, the legislative audit report. And we talked a little bit about real estate. It's been bandied around a little bit. Let me tell you, in real estate right now, there's four people out of that 16, or 11.3, there's four that's running to real estate. Real estate's been a real problem, as we all know, because of the depression that hit us started in 1986 or so. A real big problem. This fund, PERS and TERS, as well as the Police and Fire and a lot of others, were into real estate mortgages and what have you back in a big way. The PERS and TERS, as I can tell, has not invested in any real estate mortgages for a long time, and that percentage has decreased substantially since 1985. So it's working its way down, and Police and Fire is working its way down. Most people are trying to work their way out of that, but it's been a real problem. And so then they talk about contracted services and $4.8 million for PERS and TERS and only $3.4 million for the Permanent Fund Corporation. Or it would cost 16 basis points to run PERS and TERS and only 5.2 for the Permanent Fund. But that's really due to the difference in the equity portfolio. It costs a lot of money to run an equity portfolio versus a fixed portfolio. And that's where this 1% increment in return came from, $50 million. So we're talking about an extra $1 million or so to run PERS and TERS, but it earned an extra $50 million, so that $4 or $5 million is pretty small. Okay, and I've got some other information if anybody's interested in any of that. And so based on above, I think Treasury has done a reasonably good job. There were a few problems and maybe some substantial problems, but they're certainly not out of control, nor were their poor investment returns. In fact, I think it's been quite the opposite. The proposed legislation, I think, is to fix a problem that probably doesn't really exist. Yes, a board, a fiduciary board, is probably a well-conceived concept, a board that would help manage the funds. But that board, like in the proposed Senate Bill 10, could have resided where it is right now, right in revenue. You wouldn't have had to create a separate corporation. And a separate corporation, I think, will probably have more money. And I think more importantly, it's going to be an entity unto its own, and an entity with no accountability to the people through the people's elected representatives and the governor. Now, let's not forget that the state, the general fund, is responsible for paying the benefits, okay? The state is responsible for the benefits. These people that are retired, and I hope the state is around to pay their benefits, the people that are retired are getting their money from the state. This pension fund has been set aside and funded to help pay those benefits. If the pension fund monies go away, the state of Alaska general fund is going to have to step in and pay those benefits. It's the state. The members are guaranteed a benefit, guaranteed, constitutionally guaranteed a benefit by a state constitution. There can be no diminishment of benefits. They're guaranteed a benefit, that means the state pays it. And I think that means a lot, and there's a lot that goes behind that. That is, so when you talk about the composition of the board, people have testified that we think there should be more members from here and from there and all that. Those people are going to get their benefit. So we need a board, we need a fiduciary that's going to be really focused on making money for the board. And not just making money, of course, but mindful of risk. We talked about SBS and the GICs and things like that. First Executive put money into First Executive in 1988, and there were rumors back then that First Executive was having problems with that. We bought a big GIC in First Executive in those years. But so we need somebody that can get in there and manage this money and be aware of the financial instruments and financial markets. And the board will be comprised of what's currently proposed of four members. And when I mean members of PERS and TERS or whatever. And then two from political subdivisions, and one would be the Commissioner of Revenue. We really have a member board here. That's not to say that the Commissioner of Revenue is not a member, because the Commissioner of Revenue, just like all state employees, are members of the PERS system. So we're all members. Some may be vested, some may not be, but we're all members, and we all kind of have a vested interest in this thing. And then one's going to be elected by the above. So it's really controlled by, you might say, there's the employee side, which is four. And remember, I'm kind of mindful of this employee side because of my workings on the police and fire retirement system. So you have the employee side, and you have some of these others. And so they've got the block of votes. They've got the four to elect the eighth member, the way it's constituted. And we've got a board where the members cannot be removed unless they're physically or mentally incapable of continuing on. And I think the governor should have this responsibility of making sure that the board is doing a good job. And I know that's been the subject of a lot of discussion. And these elected members coming up from PERS and TERS, sometimes that's more of a popularity contest than perhaps than what it is from somebody that has astute investment management background. And then we've heard about this advisory council. This board, as it states in the bill, can use the advisory council to any extent it wants. It doesn't even have to use it, because it also provides that the board can hire an investment advisor. So if you hire an investment advisor, why do you need an investment advisory council? I don't know which one it is. Is it a council, or is it an investment advisor, or is it both? I mean, and just don't know. And maybe that's duplication of effort and additional money. The staff, they're all exempt employees. The permanent fund has all exempt employees. There's a few exempt employees in Treasury. And these people, probably the first, second, and third highest paid people in the state work for Treasury or the permanent fund. And they can set their own salaries for everybody. They're exempt. The bill proposes that they're exempt from the procurement code. I think most people would like that. I think if you talk to a lot of state employees, you have to go through the procurement code. You'd like to be exempt from that. Well, these people can be exempt. I mean, they are exempt. They can hire their own legal counsel. They have their own legal counsel. But on the other hand, the state has to come in and identify, defend and identify the fiduciary if they act imprudently. I mean, if they act prudently. So they have their own legal counsel. They do their own board. They do everything. But the governor has really no control over the members. But yet the state has to step in and identify them and defend them. SB 18 also includes SBS, the Supplemental Benefit System. The Supplemental Benefit System, of course, is not a pension fund. It's the employee's money. I mean, employees are vested from day one in that money that goes into SBS. In a lot of systems like that, the employees have some opportunity to direct investments. I mean, there could be a standard one, which is a low risk, like U.S. Treasuries, but if the employees want to, you know, some people have different investment modes. Some like to have their monies into high growth type stocks. Some like to be secure. Say, this is all I've got for my retirement, so I'm going to stay in U.S. Treasuries or government-backed securities, so my money's there. And that's what they want. We're now talking about what we're going to do about SBS, and I won't get into that, but there's been a lot of discussions about that. And especially when it comes to deferred comp. I mean, this board can also give make advice and has the authority to make advice over investments of deferred comp. I mean, my goodness, this is an entirely elective process if an individual wants to get into the deferred comp program. And I really believe in that area, the person that invests in deferred comp or has participants in that should have the say in where that money's invested. I mean, I think that's their own money, kind of like an IRA, should have their own say. And overall, it seems like we're doing a lot here, kind of overkill to create a separate authority to cure some management-type problem. I mean, in conclusion, I think the state is being stripped of its authority as the fiduciary. The state's going to have the ultimate responsibility, but no authority to manage the money. Anyway, those are my comments. Thank you.
Thank you for such a glowing support of this bill.
Yes, glowing support of the concept, Mr. Chairman, for a shared fiduciary board.
Can you tell me if this bill was to go out of here to the House floor in its present condition, what would Revenue's recommendation be to the government?
Well, my recommendation, I don't know what the Commissioner of Revenue, I can't speak for him, but my recommendation would be not to approve it.
Representative,
are you speaking here for the department or for yourself, sir?
The commissioner and I have had some discussions over this, and the commissioner indicated previously on a bill analysis that he was in favor. He supported SB 10 with some mechanical changes, and he opposed SB 18. And this one's basically SB 18. SB 10 would have created a board within the Department of Revenue.
My question again.
So I believe I'm speaking as far as the creation of a separate pension corporation with an autonomous board and all that. I'm speaking for the commissioner. I'm sharing his thoughts too. I haven't gone over all my testimony with him.
It is kind of unusual for us to have a deputy commissioner who is not speaking for the commissioner. I just wanted to clear on the record whether you were representing the commissioner.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I am not the commissioner, so I can't speak. You know, I'm not the commissioner. I'm speaking on behalf of the Department of Revenue. So if you want to call that speaking for the commissioner, then maybe I am. But I have not shared these comments in detail with him. We've talked about the concepts that I'm referencing here.
Representative Shilkett.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Rexnickel, on a position paper signed by the commissioner on the 11th of February, the commissioner says that the Department of Revenue supports basic concepts of this legislation for the following reasons. I draw your attention to number two, which says the department believes the fiduciary responsibility should not solely rest with the Commissioner of Revenue, and of course that a board would govern investments. To govern investments would improve accountability, public visibility, and continuity. Also on the last paragraph, he makes a comment that establishment of an investment corporation would afford similar access to the Department of Administration with respect to investment matters. I for one, thank you for your presentation. You answered a lot of my questions, and I think I might have some basic fundamental problems with this bill, but it appears the commissioner does support the bill.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I think the one that you have there, it's, I've got, I'm not sure if I have what you have, but there's a bill analysis here, and one is department position, that's SB 10, it says support, but it goes down here and it talks about maybe some mechanical type changes.
We have one, sir, that's on SB 18 and House Bill 37.
Right, and that says opposed.
Boy, I couldn't find where it said opposed, Bill. That's not the same one we got. Yeah.
Well, I don't have that one, but let me do have this one.
Mr. Chairman, Commissioner Fisher, he was relatively new at that time also, and I think regardless, we're entitled to continually review, and I think as managers, we should always be reviewing what we're doing and seeing if we're approaching things in the right position and that we're doing our best job as managers and, I guess, as keeping the state in a proper course of action. I don't really see the position paper. I see where it is signed by the commissioner.
Maybe, Mr. Chairman, we can get copies of what he has.
No, maybe what we'll do, Mr. Rex Winkle, is to ask you please to provide us with a new position paper in reference to Senate Bill 18 in its present form, signed by the commissioner.
I will do that.
If I could ask one more quick question, sir.
Representative Choquette.
On the fiscal note, you have two positions signed by the commissioner. On page one of two, you saw a fiscal note of $10.1 million for 92, jumping to $20.2 million for 93. And then in the next fiscal note, dated the same date, you back out $9,800 for 92 and $19,700 for 93. I don't fully understand that, Darrell.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Choquette, I don't understand either. I don't have that. I'd have to analyze it and find out what happened there.
I'd surely like an answer to that question, too.
Mr. Chairman, one thing that would happen, of course, is if the equities grew in the portfolio, the contractual services cost would increase. It does cost about 30 basis points to run an equity portfolio.
It appears to be backed out somehow.
Okay.
From the original figure, Darrell. I just don't understand. We've got somewhere we're missing close to $300 million between the two, the discrepancy. I just wondered.
$300 million?
Mr. Rexwinkle, if we could please have you also review the fiscal notes and see if they are accurate as this bill is presently in its present form, along with the commissioner's position on the bill in its present form. How long would it take you to have that for us? Well, the law says 5 days. Can you have it in 5 days?
I can do it in 5 days.
All right, if you could, sir. Any other questions from the committee at this time? I appreciate your time, sir.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Is there anyone else that wishes to testify, Mr. Burgess?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Scott Burgess with Lasky Municipal League. I apologize for being late. I had to give a presentation to some folks in town. I did submit written testimony dealing with a specific issue that I'd been before you on a similar piece of legislation.
We have that testimony, legislation. Mr. Burgess.
And I believe there were some questions. I just wanted to reiterate, when I spoke to you before, we have a very specific interest in this part of this bill dealing with tax exemption. And in the previous piece of legislation, the House piece, 37, the committee chose to just remove the whole section. When I spoke before you, I was after a specific item, which is in another piece of legislation, which is moving through the process. This is also something we tried to deal with last year, unfortunately missed it by a day in the last session. The amendment addresses that specific item, and that's what we're interested in, my folks. We're trying to deal with property which is being held through foreclosure or deed in lieu of foreclosure for an investment purpose, where in fact we're providing services to that property which maintain the value of that property and perhaps even enhance it for resale, where in fact that property may be in competition with the private sector, where leases or rents are actually being charged in competition with the private sector, where the private sector is in fact having to pay taxes on that. So it's a very focused issue. We appreciate the committee's action on the other bill, but quite frankly, this is what we want, and we appreciate the sponsors working with us and offering this amendment. And otherwise, we support the bill. We realize that there are lots of, it's interesting to hear the different sides. The league got involved in this issue late last year when we didn't have the issue before us. We spent the summer, we talked to the prior administration at our legislative committee meetings, we had hearings and issues discussed on this bill at our annual conference, and the league did take a position in favor of this bill. We think SB 18 does represent basically our concerns for a separate corporation. In fact, provides a balance on the board of beneficiaries and employers, and as municipal officials, we're interested in the beneficiaries are our employees, and also in the contributions we make to that system to make sure that we're getting the best return on that dollars to, quite frankly, keep the cost of that program down as much as possible, and to ensure that it is able to provide the benefits when necessary. So we think the bill is balanced, and with the addition of that amendment, we think it meets the league, and we would encourage its passage and your support.
Thank you, Mr. Burgess. Questions from the committee?
One quick question, Mr. Chairman. Then you support the amendment as it sits, dealing only with foreclosure contempt. And you've talked with the municipality bankers on this?
Yes. Mr. Chairman, Representative Choquette, that is
Mr.
correct.
Bridges.
This is specifically what has come up through the assessors, municipal assessors around the state, through the league. There may be an interest in sort of the bigger picture, but this is the one we focused on, and we specifically have a piece of legislation in the other house that's moving through and moved through the body last year, and this is the issue we dealt with, this aspect.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Bruckman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have some questions on when you indicate that municipalities have to fix up homes to sell it, is the way I understood it, or had expenses and selling the property. It was my understanding that the expenses would be a lack of income because non-payment of taxes, but that the mortgage holder, the banks, are the ones that sell the house. They're the real owner of the home or property or business. So I'm a little confused on the actual expense to municipalities on proposed properties.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bruckman, the issue I'm trying to raise is that a piece of property sits out there in a municipality. It has roads to it, has water to it, has
right.
police services, fire. All that goes to enhance that property or maintain its value. And the provision of those services is a public expense.
Right, and because you're not being paid taxes on it currently.
Right, and therefore that value added is not returning to the municipality and is essentially a value to that piece of property, and therefore it should be compensated. The property owner should compensate the provider of that service, just like the private sector does anybody that has to pay just on your house. The value of your house is maintained by the fact, and you'll see a value increase if all of a sudden, as the extended water service in North Douglas, all of a sudden the value of that property is increased. But if that property was tax exempt, there'd be no return for providing that service out to that property and enhancing the value of that property. So this is just what we feel is a fair compensation for that service.
If we might maybe leave this topic, we're running out of time here, and this is an amendment that eventually the amendment will be taken up and we'll discuss that issue in further detail. Representative Grunberg.
I just have one comment I wanted to put my finger on. I mentioned to Mr. Raxwinkle. I can understand the commissioner, and I know you're speaking in this respect for the commissioner and what you testified here today. I don't think this bill is meant, at least speaking personally, as a criticism of the commissioner or the past commissioners of revenue.
I think the question is really who decides whether it's appropriate for the Commissioner of Revenue to be making the decision, whether there should be a board involved. And that's really at the central part of the bill, one of the central issues. And it's really a question of how state government is structured vis-a-vis the relationship between the Commissioner of Revenue and this large pension board, whether they should be one and the same, or whether they should be, there should be a dichotomy there. And that's a policy question. And it rises far above the performance of the pension fund this time vis-a-vis the performance of any other fund, permanent fund, whatever fund we happen to be comparing it to. That, I don't consider that to be the issue. I think it deals with the structuring of government in this respect, and that is a major policy issue. And in other states, one of the major issues in the 1990 legislative session in several states is whether in states where there are serious financial problems, there should be state borrowing from their pension plans to maintain the revenues necessary to support those states. I don't anticipate that happening, and God willing, will never happen in this state. I think that's a terrible set of facts when it comes to that. But if that were to occur, I think there would be definitely a conflict of interest if the Commissioner of Revenue were in charge of the fund and would be in a position where the government would have to borrow from the fund that he was a trustee over. And that, I think, is something we need to keep in mind. And I would hope that the Department of Revenue and this committee would be viewing that particular bill, this particular bill, in terms of the much broader issues presented. Thank you.
Hi, we're actually out of town. This bill will not go to subcommittee. It will be scheduled for further hearings in full committee. The next meeting, we had two bills. I might say I wanted to deal with Senate Bill 32 relating to tourist benefits for youth center employees and House Bill 40, which has been in subcommittee. We will be carrying those bills forward. The next meeting of House State Affairs will be Monday, March 18th, 1991. We have a full calendar. HCR 11, Alaska Women's Commission, HCR 12, Susitna Basin Motorized Use Restrictions, HCR 13, 25th Annual Boys State, HCR 14, Girls State, HCR 15, Boys State, HB 170, relating to Women's Commissions to the Legislative Branch, and SCR 1, relating to the Amateur Radio Week. So please be on time Monday morning.
What time are we starting? About 6 in the morning?
Yes, sir. And so come back from Anchorage if you're going on Sunday night, please.
I thought you were going to say don't give you any static on the radio.
Any comments?
Say
we're adjourned at 9:54.